Be clear what you know and don't know.
The most important thing for me as a leader is my team.
I did my first deal as a student.
So every couple of weeks, TL Partners, my leadership and productivity strategy consulting firm, hosts an invite-only fireside chat, where we get to speak with business leaders of all different stripes about some of the most pertinent issues affecting their organizations. One of the recent conversations we had was on mergers and acquisitions, and in particular, on day one readiness, how you can use the diligence process in order to best set yourself up for success on day one post an acquisition. This is a deviation from our typical venture visionary stories. Rather than being embedded in the story of a single person, we're going to be embedded in the strategies of a single moment in time in the evolution of a business. This conversation was really highly regarded by our audience. There was a request to share it out more broadly. And so our answer to that request is yes. Without further ado, here's an abridged recording of our conversation on day one readiness with mergers and acquisitions. Let's dive in. Good morning, afternoon, evening to everyone, depending on where you're joining us from in the world. I'm thrilled to welcome you today to today's panel discussion for TL Partners Fireside Chats on day one readiness, laying the groundwork for successful M&As in due diligence. That's a mouthful, and it's because it's a pretty big topic for us. So as we're delving into this critical topic today, my goal is to equip us all with some really actionable insights and strategies that are not only going to prepare us for the complexities of mergers and acquisitions, but also ensure that there's a smooth transition and successful integration from day one. And for those of us who've had experience with M&As, we know how difficult that can be. And so our hope today is that you gain a deeper understanding of how to build trust early, integrate cultures effectively, retain key talent, adapt your leadership styles, and measure the success of integration efforts. I'm really excited because we are supported by a really killer panel today to kind of guide us on that effort. So we have Nicoletta Vlamis, who's the founder and CEO of Nicoletta & Associates, a trailblazing boutique management consultancy that is known for elevating business leadership beyond profits to strategic and sustainable growth. She founded NK in 2013, and since then, Nicoletta has expanded to services across North America and Europe, and she's partnered with industry giants like Microsoft and Adidas, as well as a number of smaller firms. And NKA is dedicated to supporting investment firms with the people diligence and change management essential for successful M&As. We're so excited to have you, Nicoletta. We also have Warren Ragunanan, who is a seasoned corporate lawyer with a focus on the transaction-driven practice. So Warren comes to us with a passion for closing deals, especially those that align financial goals with social and environmental sustainability, something that I think feels ever more pressing and urgent in the world that we live in. His expertise spans structuring startups, business acquisitions, and international corporate deals, and that makes him a key contributor to our discussion on all things, but particularly the legal and strategic facets of M&A. And then we have Teresa Roswell, who brings over two decades of experience navigating through diverse roles at an executive level. She's done so at prominent companies like Target, Lululemon, Gap Inc. More recently, she's functioning as a fractional CEO and executive strategic advisor, supporting companies across kind of the size spectrum, everything from kind of the large players, like the names you'd recognize, to smaller folks who are just getting started and pushing themselves to grow. She has a pretty formidable track record in driving profitability, in managing complex mergers, and spearheading international expansions. I'm excited for her insights today, and in particular, how we're going to leverage her experience on how to unify product, technology, and customer experience with vision and strategy as we think about kind of creating new entities through M&As. So I want to thank you all for joining us today. I'm really excited to have you. I want to kick us off actually with a quick poll before we begin. And I'd love to hear from our group of attendees. What's your primary interest in today's discussion on M&As? We'll give us about 30 more seconds. Make sure that everybody can participate. Fantastic. And so it looks like just for our panelists, we have quite a bit of interest on understanding strategies for building trust early and gaining insights into leadership transition, and then some about cultural integration techniques. Good news is we're going to hit all of those as well as a few other things as well. Enough from me. I would love to start to hear from our panelists. And my first question out is, could each of you share a little bit of your professional journey and describe how you specifically got involved in M&A? Teresa, I'll have you kick us off.
I've been, throughout my career, I've been on both the acquiring side of M&A as well as the acquiree side of M&A. I've worked in public companies and private companies, mostly in retail services and SaaS-based tech companies. We've done transactions in Canada, the US, Europe, and I've worked on different size of deals, ranging from a couple million dollars with like 1 to 5 employees all the way up to $50 or $60 million and hundreds of employees that are in multiple countries. Throughout my career, I've held different roles, everything from executing in due diligence to being an executive who's working on M&A strategy, like helping the organization to achieve its goals. And then today I sit with founders and companies who are going through a specific M&A and just help navigate the path forward with that transaction.
Thanks, Teresa. What about you, Warren?
So what's interesting is I did my first deal as a student. In Canada, before we can become lawyers, we have to go through a process called articling, where we're a student and we're learning. And at the place where I was articling, it so happened that the associate left and they had nobody to do this deal. And I had a business background already before I went to law school. And they said, you do it. That's how articling works, pretty much, right? Nobody else wants to do it, so you do it. And it was, I will never forget it, because it was the sale of a garden supply store by an owner that was retiring to an employee. And I did it. I would shudder to look back at it. If I looked at it today, I'd wonder what I was looking at, but I did it. And then I kept doing it. And I kept learning and kept going and kept going. And it's become a fundamental part of everything I do today.
Want to dig into that a little bit more as we go in. And what about you, Nicoletta?
So I was thinking before Nicoletta and Associates, when I first moved to Canada, I'm originally from California. When I first moved to Canada, I was working for a mid-sized tech firm, and I was responsible for the integration of an acquisition. And that was my first, I guess we would call that PMI. Now I didn't know what that was at the time. And that was my first entree into that piece of work. And then in the context of Nicoletta and Associates, which is predominantly a firm focused on reframing change and heavily focused on the human experience of that, we found our way organically into the people side of due diligence and, as desired by the business leader, in the post-merger integration, and have done that a couple of times. And so that's kind of how you found me here.
Cool. Thanks, Nicoletta. So we're going to dive right in. One of the things that our attendees were most kind of interested in was building trust early. So Nicoletta, I want to kick off with you. What are some of the strategies that you've found to be most effective for building trust and transparency during the due diligence process of M&A?
Yeah, I think we were talking about that, Thomas. Teresa, actually, in one of her firms, brought in Nicoletta and Associates specifically for due diligence. And so my question to Teresa yesterday was, so can you give me your experience of what it was like? Because we didn't know each other. We were not entities that knew each other. We knew people who knew each other, but Teresa and I did not know each other. And I asked Teresa, so what was your experience? I can share mine as well, having partnered super intensely with Teresa for 21 days. And we talked about three things. One was what we talked about at the beginning of our first meeting, which was how we thought about people and organization. And I often call that the intention, which is this is how I like to believe I operate. And I share that. And we talked about some common companies. There was some language that resonated with both of us. And it was a way of shaping how we thought about, especially during times of accelerated change, which due diligence is one of those, or accelerated activity. I don't know if it's per se change, but it's activity, speed. So that was the first part that we spoke about. And the second part was really basic stuff, which is listening deeply, playing back in emotionally time sensitive times. So when it matters, sharing what it is not yours to do, meaning be clear what you know and don't know, even though your swim lanes are pretty tight. Be able to share that I may not be the best person on that, but I can assist by connecting. And then doing that all in a time, which is follow through. That combined with being what I think Teresa and I would say is not just available in communication, consistently available, but emotionally sensitive and responsive. And so that, especially as it relates to people in these kind of deals where we're chasing an outcome and an arbitrary date, as Warren says, becomes super important. And then what I found was really helpful is what I would call if the first conversation was the intention, then the third part of what Teresa said is, and when I heard about Nicoletta and Associates, or Nicoletta specifically, amidst my internal leader meetings, I heard either neutral or positive to what was stated as the intent. That's a form of listening in a different way, but checking to see if what was there, in addition to what Teresa's personal experience was, who was the lead and a primary stakeholder for me. And so I share that because that resulted in, hopefully, I would think, Teresa and I would say, an establishment of psychological safety, because speed is, you know, without that, you can move fast, but there's a lot of damage that can happen if the trust is not there and the safety is not established. And to do that quickly always takes two people, or more than two people, but in this case, just taking Teresa and I.
One of the things you mentioned that feels on one hand very intuitive, but maybe a bit amorphous, is that it's not just listening kind of for the words or the facts, but for the emotional state of what is happening. I'm paraphrasing, and where it goes through. I'm wondering if you could kind of make that real for us. What is the difference between just kind of listening for what is said versus keeping a pulse on kind of what is happening emotionally and culturally? What, for example, are the kind of insights that you find yourself looking for or aware of in the latter that might be missed in the former? And I'm curious, Nicoletta, about your perspective there. But Teresa, given that this...
Yeah, I would welcome that
relationship as well. I'd also welcome your sense of, was there something different about how NKA listened? And what does that tactically look like for someone who's like trying to listen in that way?
Yeah, so I'm really putting myself back into this scenario as you're talking, and I'm thinking about how quickly you have to move and how much has to be accomplished. And the most important thing for me as a leader is my team, because I know that that's going to make or break the success of any culture integration, the acquisition success. And so I'm looking for cues, as Nicoletta mentioned, when she's in the room or when she's not in the room. And so I'm high touch with my team. We're talking frequently and often, and I'm asking questions but also reading their body language, also getting a sense of how, you know, what my baseline is for how they operate and how they interact. And so when I bring up Nicoletta's name or any third party that we've introduced, I'm looking for their verbal cues, their nonverbal cues. I'm looking for a change in how they're working when they're in the room versus they're not in the room. And so if I know my team, I work with my team all the time. And so if they're operating in their normal state, I'm feeling a sense of confidence. The other piece is things like availability. You know, I had many occasions where I'm operating, I've got 1,000 things going on, and I'm ready to come in and blitz Nicoletta with, I need this, 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 and this, yeah. As a good A-type personality that I am. But she would take that moment to take a breath and say, okay, got it. I heard this, this, and this. Now, how are you doing? Are you good? Is there anything else you need support in? And so taking those moments, what it does is just take you from that sort of like thinking space into that feeling space. And then I'm like checking in with myself. Okay, yeah, thank you for that. But I know if she's taking care like that with me, then I can make a safe assumption that she's taking care like that with my team. Like I said, you have to check in with your team when she's not in the room to make sure that that's happening. But I've had to make that an intentional part of how I'm operating too. So going into it early on, checking on those things, making sure it's working so I can course correct if I feel like something's off.
Warren, I kind of want to pull you in here. One of the things that you are known for and great at is kind of sustainability, both in kind of the broader climate sustainability, but also when I think about deal resilience. And I know in just some of our talking and knowing about you that you've done a lot of thinking on what it actually takes to get the deal to make it all the way through. I'm curious, from your perspective, what are some of the critical deal resilience strategies that you find yourself coaching teams to, or that you observe teams not applying that end up messing up on deal resilience down the road? And why do you think those things end up being such challenges?
It's such a great question, because it's not exciting, these strategies. These strategies are really very much bread and butter. Valuable business, one that somebody wants to buy, is a well-run business. Got a value proposition for its clients or customers. It has, you know, a solid set of assets, maybe some unique techniques. It makes a product that it has good relationship with its supply chains, if it's a good, or if it's a service, a good relationship with its clients, and it's well run. And so the things that cause deals to fall apart are the things that are overlooked in governance. And so maybe it's, for a larger organization, it's a very poorly performing division. They haven't hit their revenue targets for some number of years, but the C-suite has more important things to deal with than this tiny underperforming division. You know, nobody asks the questions or investigates as to what's going on. For smaller or medium-sized businesses, it's the basics of having a bookkeeping system and an infrastructure or record keeping. I can't tell you the number of deals for fairly substantial mid-sized companies, but privately held, where they tell me they want to sell shares. And I say to them, oh, okay, great. Let's take a look at your corporate records and your minute book. And let me take a look at what the share structure looks like. And they say, what's a minute book? When I get that question back, and I delve into it a little bit and find out that, you know, maybe they set up their business like 15 years ago and talked to a lawyer once, and they just don't understand the basics of what types of documents you need to prove that you in fact own this business, what it takes to set up a proper bookkeeping system and the quarterly reports that you should be getting. Those are all of the things that need to be addressed in order to create deal resilience and just operational resilience.
Why would someone not have a well-run company?
The devil is in the details on that question, right? Mm-hmm. People all have different priorities and different ideas of what a company should be focusing on. And sometimes that makes a lot of sense. When a company first starts and you're struggling, and you're in your first 5 years, the thing that's most important is getting money through the door. Fantastic. What is the point? There's no point in spending a lot of money on HR and marketing if you have to turn around in 5 years, right? Over time, maybe years 5 to 10, 10 to 15, or as you start to get larger, you need to start putting pieces in place to make the business more operationally efficient and more resilient. But sometimes there's people that don't want to put in that work, or maybe there's more important things to do, or maybe there's parts of the business that they feel more comfortable with. Larger organization with somebody stepping in, maybe they don't have full eyes on everything that they know. That maybe if they're coming in from the sales or from the marketing side or from the HR side, they understand the people systems very well. But they might not understand, okay, well, what are things that need to be shored up in your bookkeeping and your quarterly reporting? Or what are some operational issues? Like, hey, has a lease for your plant, has that expired? And you're month to month, and you've been month to month for the last 2 years? Like, those are questions that they don't even think to ask.
I might add a couple of things there. So one, when I go into companies that are growing, oftentimes what I'll see is that the company is really strong in the areas that the founder is passionate about and where the founder is really coming from. Yeah. So you go company, and there's like a product founder who's like, you know, very like obsessed with like product details and design and how things function. And those areas tend to be super strong. Their strength is not in operations or finance. And so you see that there isn't as much structure or maturation that's happened in those areas. I think the other thing is when companies are being really successful, so if they're doing a great job of getting customers through the door and cash is flowing, they often are just, they're just in overdrive trying to keep up with the pace of the growth and don't always think about the foundational footing that's going to be required as they grow. They're just on that growth wave. And so it's not that they're not well run or they don't have a good product. It's just that not every aspect of the business is necessarily being thought of with the same level of passion and focus.
Teresa, I know something that you mentioned that you think a lot about are kind of culture leaders, kind of how are people doing. Could you discuss some of the challenges of merging companies with different cultures? And very specifically, what do you see as the roles of the leaders in driving that process?
There's definitely varying degrees of challenges when it comes to cultural integrations. And there's a few things that are really going to impact that. So one is, how many people are we talking about? So how many people are actually going to be impacted by the change of this acquisition? What degree is your product or your service changing? To what degree? How many new geographies are being introduced into the equation? And so I find that the greater the change, the greater the challenge. The root of the challenges most often are coming from a lack of clarity and an inability to establish trust between the teams. And it's tricky because you've got companies that are each coming to the table. They've got their own set of values. They've got their own language that they use, how they define success or the expectations that they have in terms of working with each other or their customers. They're going to be different. And so as a leader, one of the most important things that you can do is to help provide that clarity and that alignment. You know, you are inserting change into the equation here, and people generally will resist change. And so the extent to which you can alleviate any fears and help them understand what to expect will help you move through that transition quicker. And the number one thing that people want to know when an M&A is taking place is, what does this mean for me? What is changing? And then so, you know, as a leader, you want to help guide that path forward. So you're fostering an environment of trust, helping the team to establish those ways of working. You're clarifying expectations and you're communicating often. And as the team stabilizes, you can kind of dial back on your communication, but you've got to be talking to them a lot in different ways. You're talking to them in person. You're having one-on-ones. You're using your Slack channel. You're doing the different things to make sure people are, you're clearing up ambiguity and people are able to understand what their role is and how they're contributing to, you know, integration that's taking place.
You know, speaking about the role of leaders and how things adjust, Nicoletta, I'll come back to you for a second. How do you think leadership styles should adapt during a merger and acquisition? Do you think it requires different things of leaders, or what it means to be a great leader, what it means to be a great leader, and that applies across the board? I'm curious where you land on that. And regardless, what are some of the things that if you're doing a leadership assessment on the right kind of leadership traits necessary to take this journey, you'd be looking for?
I don't know that I know what we tend to use the word style. You know, we use that a lot, like about style. I just had a conversation this morning that was around kind of that. And I think the way I would frame it to speak specifically about due diligence and post-merger and then make some connections from that would be, I tend to think the most effective leadership, and then you look for this, is dynamic leadership. Dynamic, you know, there's kind of situational we've heard. I've heard lately some adaptive leadership language out there. And the reason I choose dynamic and tend to use that is it also has an underlying component of self-awareness in that. So dynamic means that I understand the context to the best that I have access to. I seek to understand the context the most. I therefore look in my business leadership set of skills, financial, operational, people, change, and then I dial up or down depending on the situation, and I augment with those that I'm not. That underline is quite a bit of self-awareness to know what I'm not beyond my passion, maybe beyond my strength, to just know what is needed for that moment. So specifically for due diligence, we've talked about, it tends to be a time where feet is super important. And like Warren has said, it could be an arbitrary date, but we're running to get lots of information. Like Teresa said, super quickly, 10 things I need to know. And so in that, that is a specific kind of leadership. When we're brought in, if I stay with the example of Teresa and I, we also had a role to coach Teresa and her peers to get ready for the integration and to get ahead that if it did go through. So while we were delivering what we needed to in that moment, and those leaders were super task focused and check the box, build trust, we were also preparing for if this were to go live, what do you as a leader want to consider? And as Teresa said, the people side, which is, will I lose my job? What's going to change for my job? When will I know about that? Those can be contemplated in due diligence equally. And that is a second component, but it may not be acted on until another 30 or 60 days. So I tend to use dynamic with the assumption that we have a set of capabilities as business leaders, and we dial those up and down pending.
If I'm a CEO, or particularly the executive team of a CEO that's kind of prepping ourselves from an M&A, what do we need to get smart on as we look towards a potential deal?
So from the seller perspective, somebody comes to me saying that they want to sell. First question that I ask them is, why? Are you retiring? Are you tired of this? Are you doing really well and it's really valuable and you found a great integration partner? What's going on? The second question that I ask them is, when do you want to sell? The answer that I almost always get back is, as quickly as possible. And then I have to sit down and have an expectation setting discussion with them about what the process looks like. And then, you know, you've got to find a buyer first, and there's a confidentiality agreement and a letter of intent and due diligence and then agreements and all of these things, right? And then you need milestones and you need to plan things out. Aside from all of the questions that I was alluding to earlier about good governance and what the sort of shortcomings are in the business, the next thing that I ask them for is, if once you find a buyer, first of all, send me your financial statements, because I want to see what you're spending money on. And I also want to see which areas in your income statement, say, among your expenses, I think might be ripe for questions for due diligence. You know, if you're spending a lot of money on professional service, you're spending a lot of money on lawyers here, right? Why? If you're spending a lot of money on, say, capital expenditures or real estate, why? What's going on here? Are you expanding? Are you building? What's going on, right? And that sort of frames how we do our planning from the sell side. From the buy side, I'm asking the buyer similar questions. Why are you doing this? What's the point? What's going on, right? And 90% of the time, there's usually a business objective along the lines of, well, this particular company is doing some really interesting work, or they have a really great asset and we'd like to acquire it and integrate it into our operation. There's other reasons too. Sometimes they're a competitor and they want to get them out. Sometimes they're just like, they need to expand. Like, one of the most common ones from the buy side is a foreign buyer, a foreign entity maybe wants to establish a market presence in Canada or the United States, or in Canada as a bridge to the United States. They're, in addition to learning the cultures of the business that they're acquiring, learning the business culture of Canada and North America. And so on the buy side, I'm asking a similar question. I'm saying, you want to see financial statements, right? You want to see where this company's spending money on. You want a confidentiality agreement in place first, and then you want to start thinking about the due diligence that you want to do. The expectation setting I'm setting with the buyers is, you need to understand that every business in existence on planet Earth has problems. All of them. You will not find a, like, this is a collection of human beings cooperating to sell a product or a service. There's absolutely no way everything's happening perfectly smooth. What's your deal breakers? What are you prepared to walk away from? What are things that are just really important to you that should be addressed? And what are the things that, you know, if they pop up, if there's a risk, you don't really care all that much, right? If you're a consultant, if you're buying a consulting firm, for example, because you want to set up a market presence in Canada, and your potential target has an office, right? But maybe you're virtual. Maybe the office isn't that important. Maybe if the landlord doesn't want to transfer over the lease, who cares? You'll just find, you'll set up virtually temporarily. Whereas if there's certain key clients that don't necessarily want to come over with you, that's a very different story. Those are the kinds of questions that I'm asking about at a very early planning stage. Assuming, of course, that they're asking me in the first place, because, you know, there's a good 70% chance that they're not coming to me until they're 6 or 7 months in and they've got like a 30-page agreement that they have no idea what it's.
I want to shift gears a little bit and really think about how we measure success with this kind of work. And Teresa, particularly given your role, one, the number of times you've done this in-house, and then now kind of coming on as a fractional CEO, really helping lots and lots of folks think through this. What metrics or indicators do you consider crucial in gauging the success of an integration effort?
Well, I think there's many different ways to gauge success. And my recommendation would be that you're doing a combination of all of these things. But one is, you know, making sure you're getting direct feedback. Feedback from your customers, feedback from your employees, feedback from your partners, that you're observing with your own eyes how things are going. Like, what are you seeing in terms of team chemistry, team dynamics, you know, new customer dynamics? And then also, of course, you have metrics that you can track and watch. You know, there will be some metrics that are maybe specific to a particular area of the business. So it's like if there's a department or a team that's going to be highly impacted, you'd want to look at whatever key performance indicator that they have for your business. And if they don't currently have one, I would strongly recommend that you figure out what that would be, what one could be for that group. But as I've mentioned a few times, it's really going to come down to people. So the people are going to make or break your acquisition success. It's making or breaking your business day to day. And so I always look at metrics that are around both employee and customer engagement. Mm-hmm. So whether you currently track your net promoter score or some sort of satisfaction scores, both for employees and customers, I'm looking at those, as well as customer and employee retention rates. So is there been a change in how frequently people are leaving the organization or customers are falling off? I'm looking closely at quality issues, complaints that are surfacing, and paying attention to my people, employees, and my customers.
I love how much you balance the customer and the employees. How do you then get realistic about benchmarks and timelines? Give us a sense of how one makes this real, even as you run your day-to-day business.
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, that's how I run my business. And so these are benchmarks and things that I'm looking at constantly anyway. So it's not that I'm adding in something new. I mean, this is a great way to make sure that you're running a healthy business. My last three companies, we were monitoring employee engagement every month. We are looking at our company NPS scores every week. These are part of the day-to-day ways in which we operate. What we're doing is making sure that we have a heightened awareness that we're introducing a lot of change, and people are going to resist change. They're going to have challenges moving through change. And so we're just drawing on that context. The benchmarks and timelines are really going to be specific to your business, like the type of business you're in. I would highly recommend making sure that you look at the 3 months pre-acquisition. So before the word acquisition even came into the strategy, where were we at? And then you want to monitor throughout the due diligence period as well, because your team is still managing the day-to-day operations, and now they've taken on this project of due diligence. You may or may not have brought in third parties to assist you, but like, you're starting to want to pay attention to those things as you go through, particularly if you're adding workload onto your team. And then those 90 days after that the transaction has completed are very critical. As Nicoletta was mentioning earlier, you're going to want to be dynamic in how you adjust to what's going on. If you're noticing that they're is some burnout happening in your teams and you're starting to see turnover, you want to go there. If you see that you're having quality issues with your product because you've tried to integrate two different products, you're going to want to go there. So that dynamic piece is going to be important. But where were you at 3 months before? What was the average NPS? What was the average customer retention rate? What was your, you know, average sales and all this good stuff? And then making sure you're looking at it throughout.
I love the practicality of that. I love that timeline. Nicoletta, one of the things that NKA does is this work of people diligence in supporting the overall diligence process, and primarily working with, you know, private equity or investment firms. When you kind of walk into a firm and are trying to help them understand what exactly people diligence is and why it is so important, what do you say?
There's growing interest. I don't think we need to see one more article that tells us that people break deals or, you know, all of this stuff, but it's still growing interest. So I'm kind of in two places. Maybe I'll start there. One place, which is if you're not even invited to the conversation, that's it. And it could be that it's implied that the leaders can do a version of that internally, and it may not be good enough, but there could be some implication in discussions with Warren that we've had. There's lots that come up through the legal channel that are out of the legal channel's domain, let's say, but are able to see them. So one is that you don't even get invited, just to say. And then my view on that is that you can show up, and I'll come back and speak to that, but it also has to have a receptivity and a little bit of interest of the leaders to at least bring a conversation. If you're invited in, it means that there is some interest. So I think, Teresa, about the one that we did, you had a personal, and not just you, personal interest to know that you needed not just that capability, but that capacity to be able to look at that. So I think, so one is that break water, Thomas, which is not the full answer to the question. The second is that Warren alluded to it, actually. Trust and transparency with people will help you with time. And if time kills deals, then having the people data points available to you early most could potentially help accelerate some things for you. And then you'd have to give case by case. What do you, I'm going to give you this money. But the actual trade-off for the money and the potential new data that you would get in order to make your most aware choice, potentially for mutual interest, if we're in our best game, that would be some of the things that I would be sharing. So it's additional data that helps you in that moment with some spend and helps you after, and your leaders feel more capable to deliver that on the post end.
Something that Nicoletta just said triggered something in my head as well, which is that trust and transparency are also the difference between being in court and figuring out a legal problem at a boardroom table. And that is fundamentally it. The assumption about lawsuits generally is that it's based on some very technical point of law and everybody's arguing about precedents and all of that stuff. But lawsuits at their core are fundamentally about mistrust between two people. Right? They don't necessarily care so much about the law. They let the lawyers take care about that. They're going after each other because of a people issue. When you have trust and transparency, you come to me with a legal problem. I can sit down at a table with everybody involved and I can hear everyone out and we can have a good faith discussion, different ways to solve that problem. When the trust isn't there, communication is impossible. In a lot of ways, when you have two people that don't trust each other, something as mundane as, hi, how you doing, is usually greeted with, well, what do you mean by that? Now, what are you getting at? What are you trying to find out about me? That's just absolutely critical. I can tell you it also makes my job significantly easier and also makes your legal fees significantly lower because I am spending a lot less time solving the problem for you.
I love that. I'm going to shift to some Q&A from the audience. The first question that's come in is, given how prevalent and how many case studies they are on how the people challenges kind of derail deals, why does that still feel like such a new or innovative thing for folks to kind of invest in strategically?
Well, we talked about this a little bit yesterday. I have a theory in my experience, and my theory is that deals often blossom in a boardroom. You know, you've got some board members and some executives talking about a growth strategy. And so it's not birthing from a place of people. And then it becomes a mathematical equation. What can this look like? How are profits going to grow? And so it becomes a math equation. Oftentimes, the people conversation is either not happening, it's overlooked altogether until we're in due diligence and we're doing an LOI and we're spinning up a team to support it. Or at the last minute, we're going, okay, well, we've gotten through the mechanics of the deal cycle. What about the people? And then they'll throw some money and resources at it. But I think it's where it starts. And so in instances where I've worked for really people, high culture companies and really people focused companies where the founder or the CEO has that top of mind, I see it get introduced early. And when that's not the case, it often doesn't get introduced until further down the deal cycle.
Awesome. Thank you for that, Teresa. Looking towards the future, are there any emerging trends that companies should be aware of when considering M&As, or just things that you yourselves are thinking about in a different way and you expect to change the M&A market soon?
I don't know if this is a trend. Thomas, this might resonate with you because it speaks to the growth of private equity, which is the push to specifically buy private companies and smaller businesses to try to integrate them into a larger organization. I mean, publicly traded companies, they're hard. I mean, when it comes down to it, you've got regulators all over the place and there's so many moving parts. And the math equation that Teresa was just mentioning starts to span 20 different spreadsheets as a result. And so this trend, I don't know if you'd call it a trend because private equity has been doing this for a while, right?
Yeah.
But it is intensifying.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because a lot of the problems that private equity runs into with portfolios of businesses that don't perform or aren't working properly are kind of part and parcel of the discussions we've been having. When I ask for smaller businesses, for example, one of the things that I ask them is, well, you do have a great business here, but is your business transferable? Do you have something that can operate completely independent of a founder or an entrepreneur? And private equity is definitely asking that question, because if the answer to that is no, right? The founder needs to be there, then it goes into the pile of underperforming assets, right?
Mm-hmm.
That we're betting on and lots. And so I think the private equity trend towards purchasing businesses should open up a discussion about, okay, what kind of infrastructure does this private company need so that it can survive without me? And I think the rule of thumb that I want to leave people with is, can you take a 1 month vacation and still have everything operate okay? If you can do that, then you can sell. If you can't do that, then what makes you think you can retire?
I hope you enjoyed that snippet into one of our many fascinating conversations as part of the Venture Networks for TL Partners. If you found the conversation interesting or want to learn more, don't hesitate to drop us a line. You can reach me at thomas@tlpartners.biz. That's thomas@tlpartners.biz. I'd love to geek out with you more, whether on this topic or anything else surrounding leadership and productivity. Be sure to check out our website to learn more of what we do. As always, I'm Thomas. Have a great week.